I have just one more, and this is not intended to amuse, but it probably will. You stated that your man in Upjohn was a very good collector, or was considered to be a good collector. We had in this particular incident or accident, it was fortuitous during the collection of the urine sample from Maureen Jones, the watchstander aboard the Exxon Valdez, that there happened to be another shipmate that was a female also and was able to witness the collection of the sample because the corpsman was a male. Does the DOT also have a procedure for your man in, had the, your man in, from Upjohn, that there would have been someone that would, could have witnessed if both the watchstanders and the VTS or one were a female? Is there a procedure?
First, let me point out that we don't witness the urine collection process. I mean, if you talk about observed collection under our procedures. But HHS guidelines and therefore our procedures require that there be same-sex collectors. So yes, if there had been a female VTS watchstander, we would have found a female collector. She may not have come from the same place physically as the collector did from Atlanta, but she, you know, she would have been found and sent.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your time and testimony, Ms. Allen. You're excused from the stand. I'd like to call our last witness of the day, Mr. Mark Delosier, U.S. Coast Guard, Chief Marine Safety Department, the MSO in Valdez. Mr. Delosier.
It was Lee Dickinson. He's the chairman of the Board of Inquiry here, and they're about to swear in Mark Delosier. What we've been listening to has been a little hard to pay attention to, I think, for many in Alaska, because it largely has to do with interdepartmental problems in gathering evidence between the two agencies, the NTSB, which is independent, and the Department of Transportation. They have very different views as to how evidence should be handled of drug use, and one views it as a deterrent, and the other basically views it as some facts that they need in their investigation, and that's what this was really all about. They hauled this bureaucrat down from D.C. just to talk about this in this context, and it'll probably show up someplace in their report. More important now, I think, and more to the point, is Mark Delosier. He is the Coast Guard safety officer who first boarded the Exxon Valdez on the night of the 23rd and 24th. As it's gouting oil into Prince William Sound.
You're listening to live coverage of the NTSB hearings from Anchorage, Alaska. These are made possible by KSK Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. And now we'll go to William Woody asking questions of Mark Delosier from the Coast Guard. Delosier was one of the first people on board the Exxon Valdez the night it ran into Bligh Reef.
At 6 a.m. Mr. Delosier, on the morning of the accident, the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, what time were you called or notified of the accident?
Approximately 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right. And what did you do then?
I answered the telephone and was dispatched to come to the station, put on my clothes, got in the car, and drove to the station.
Right. If you'll just very briefly describe the time you left, the time you arrived at the station, time you departed, by what means, and what time you got on the vessel.
I arrived at the station approximately 10 minutes after 1, went up to the second floor, was met with the commanding officer and the executive officer, and briefly discussed the nature of the problem. It was relayed to me both over the telephone on the initial contact that the Exxon Valdez was hard aground Bligh Reef and she was leaking oil. I came up to the second floor, met with the commanding officer and the XO. They reiterated to me the problem and proceeded to observe what was going on and settle back to make some sort of arrangements and decisions as to what we were going to do next.
Did you make any suggestions to the commanding officer or to the executive officer regarding the situation?
Yes, I did. I informed them that it would probably be prudent to get one of my men out of the department to contact the strike team, the Coast Guard strike team, which we did.
Okay. About what time did you arrive alongside the Exxon Valdez?
We arrived alongside approximately 3:15 and boarded somewhere in the neighborhood of 3:30, 3:35.
All right. When you're alongside the starboard side of the Exxon Valdez, did you witness any oil coming up out of the ship?
Absolutely. There was quite a bit of oil.
Could you describe that for us, please?
When we approached, the vessel was lit on a deck. There was tugboats sitting off the bow. At approximately 100 or 200 yards off the bow. We had to transfer from the pilot boat Silver Bullet to the pilot boat Chirkov. Apparently the decision was made to do that because the Chirkov was already somewhat dirty and they didn't want to foul the hull of the Silver Bullet. As we got onto the Chirkov, I looked around on the starboard side and witnessed an enormous amount of oil in the water. It was bubbling up around the starboard side from the bow all the way aft to the house. It was bubbling up in some areas, I would estimate 12 to 16 inches.
Okay.
The thickness of the oil, in my estimation, was somewhere around 12 to 16 inches deep on the surface.
Were there any amount of odors from the oil at that time or vapors?
There was an enormous amount of crude oil vapors present.
Was there, in your estimation, any danger of fire?
Absolutely.
Describe what you observed when you got on board the vessel.
Well, as we approached the pilot ladder, the executive officer went up the ladder first. The State Department Environmental Conservation officer went up second, and I went up third. As we get up into the main deck, we were greeted by one of the ship's crew. We walked across the cargo piping over to the port side, down the port side, and then into the elevator, up into the bridge deck.
Once on the bridge, what did you notice?
As we entered the rear of the bridge, walked into the chart room, I went around on the port side of the chart table and observed Captain Hazelwood standing up against the windshield of the wheelhouse. I observed the third mate Cousins off to the starboard side in front of the starboard radar, and the helmsman or lookout watch, AB on watch, was Maureen Jones. She was standing by the wheel.
Did you have any conversation with any of these people?
I did not have any conversations with them personally. I stepped up together with the executive officer and Dan Lawn to the master, and he was crouched over by the windshield in a position similar to this, with his hand over his mouth, covering his mouth. Had a foot up on a stool, and we went up and talked to him, and we were concerned about the safety of the ship and the crew, and we questioned him about that, what the situation was like in his opinion, and that was our prime concern at the moment, was to identify the seriousness of the condition of both the crew and the ship, to try to mitigate, if we could, any possible further damage.
Did you detect an odor of alcohol emanating from the master?
Yes, I did.
How would you characterize that, as strong or mild, or if you could?
I was standing approximately 4 foot from him, and the executive officer was off to my left, and Dan Lawn was standing behind me And I wandered around near him within a distance of 3 or 4 foot, and I would describe it as very intense. It was very, very noticeable to me.
Did afterwards, did you make any efforts to arrange for taking a toxicology test?
Well, that was not of my immediate concern at the moment. The things that we were trying to determine immediately were to ensure that the crew and personnel on board would be safe. Yes, it did cross my mind that, yes, I detected alcohol and that I should go further to try to ascertain exactly what I did smell.
Could you characterize the odor of alcohol as something that was old or such as someone who had been drinking for some hours?
Yeah, it smelled like someone had been sitting in a bar drinking for quite some time.
Okay. All right. What steps did you take to ascertain that the vessel was in safe condition or in whatever condition you found it to be?
Talking with the master, observing the deck and the other personnel on board, just to ensure that everyone was calm, had control of their faculties and things of this nature here. Talking with the master was a great help because he was able to let us know what he knew at that time, and he relayed that to the executive officer. But I did not personally have any words with him.
Did the master appear to be in possession of his faculties, and how would you characterize his performance?
I did not detect any problems with his mannerisms or any difficulties with the way he behaved, with the exception of the fact that I felt as though he was trying to cover up the odor on his breath.
By holding his hand over his mouth?
By holding his hand over his mouth, smoking cigarettes, and drinking coffee.
Right. Did you make any efforts or attempts to inform the commanding officer of the Marine Safety Office about
yes.
your findings on the ship and the master and everything?
Yes, well, my boss was with me. It was the executive officer. And after he finished a conversation with the master, I had the opportunity to pull him away, and I said, let's go outside to the starboard bridge wing and have a talk. When we got out there, I told him that I detected the odor of alcohol on the master, and he said he did too. I said, we're going to need to conduct some sort of a test to validate our observance.
Okay.
And he said that he would be making a telephone call, or he would be contacting the office soon, and that he would take steps to get someone out to do that type of a test.
If you had not detected an odor of alcohol from the captain, would you have taken test of the crew?
Yes, I would have.
Would you just very briefly describe your activities until such time as you start interviewing the crew members or taking the tox test, whichever comes first?
Well, we went out to the starboard bridge wing and had a conversation with the executive officer. I had a portable radio with me, and we determined at that time that we would call the office by radio, which we did. We called on channel 81. And we got a hold of one of the radio watchstanders there and informed them to contact the commanding officer and have him stand by the telephone, and we would be calling him by telephone shortly. And then we went down to we went back into the wheelhouse and conferred with either the third mate or the master to ascertain whether they had a Marisat telephone on board. And he said yes. One of the person that we talked to said yes. And we went down below and contacted the radio officer, who has an adjacent stateroom to the radio room. And he made arrangements and made the telephone call to the office. And the executive officer at that time talked to the commanding officer about the condition of the vessel, the stability, et cetera, the damage that we had the damage that we had been informed about, quantity of oil in the water, who was on board, and then also that we had detected the alcohol, or we had detected the smell of alcohol on one of the individuals of the crew, and that we would have to conduct some sort of testing on the people on watch.
Did you make any kind of suggestions to the exec that were passed on, say, to the CO about who you could get to take some sort of test?
Not on a first phone call, we did not, to my knowledge, or to my recollection. It was relayed to the commanding officer that we had a problem in addition to the major problem, which was the grounding of the vessel, and that in the course of all the other things that he was doing, would he please try to get someone to get someone out to conduct a test. Our initial impression, both the executive officer and myself, was that there was some sort of portable breathalyzer testing kit in town that we could somehow utilize to bring out to the ship for the purpose of testing.
Would a breathalyzer have been an adequate type of test to serve Coast Guard purposes?
At that particular moment, I did not believe that that would be the proper tool to use, but it was the only one that came to my mind during the first phone call. After he had hung up, then I started realizing that maybe there's some other way, in case we can't get a breathalyzer machine out, or if there is none available, then maybe we should start thinking about urine and blood samples.
When did you learn that there were toxicology kits on board the vessel?
Approximately 9:30, somewhere around 9:30 in the morning.
And how did this occur?
During the course of the night, we had been in communication by telephone with the office a couple of times, just to update them on what was going on with the vessel. And each and every time that we called, we finished up the conversation with, is someone coming out to test? Because as the time goes on, we're going to start losing the importance of the test, not the importance, but the alcohol or whatever we were testing for may dissipate, so we may lose it that way. So I knew that the time was important, and we did not definitely have an answer to our question on the first phone call, except for the fact that they would see what they can do. The second phone call indicated that they had gotten hold of the state police, and that the local trooper was on vacation, and a dispatcher then informed the Coast Guard that the Fish and Wildlife Officer, Trooper Mike Fox, was available and that he would be dispatched to come out to the ship.
Did he come to the vessel?
Yes, he did.
About what time did he arrive?
He arrived around 6 a.m. in the morning, 6 a.m., 6:30, somewhere about there. He arrived on the ship, came up to the wheelhouse. I had a discussion with him, told him what the problem was, and he says, geez, Mark, I'm sorry I can't help you. He said, I was under the impression that you had a wild man on board that needed to be subdued.
Could he do anything like a field sobriety test?
Yeah, he said the only thing that he could do at the moment was a field sobriety test, which would be hand-eye coordination. And I told him, I said, that would not serve our purpose. I said, we need to do some sort of an actual test on the gentleman.
Okay. Did you see anything in the captain's actions that would cause you to believe he would not have passed a field sobriety test?
Nothing.
I should ask perhaps first, are you familiar what a field sobriety test consists of?
Yes.
All right. So how did you learn that there were the toxic kits on board the vessel?
Well, after a discussion with the trooper, he relayed to me that the most effective means of conducting a test would be by drawing blood. And at that time, I went back and talked to the executive officer. We got back on the telephone and called the office and said that Trooper Fox had arrived and that he was of no real value for the purpose in which he was sent out there for. as far as the alcohol testing or drug testing was concerned, and that we still needed someone to come out at that time. They said they would check on it again and take whatever measures was necessary to get someone out. At that time, we did suggest that possibly one of the local doctors, the local police department EMTs, or one of the, or the only local lab technician might come out and conduct a blood test. It never dawned on us that we had our own corpsman that had been TAD to the office that day, but he was due to depart Valdez that morning, but we never thought about him. At some time after that conversation, someone back at the office had remembered that apparently that he was there, and they then went and found him at the airport getting on an airplane, and had brought him back over and put him on a helicopter to fly out. But prior to that, we had been back in communication on telephone, and the office knew that we were getting a bit frustrated with not being able to test. So the commanding officer suggested that maybe they have tox test kits on board. And the XO told me that, and I said, well, I don't, I said, they're not required to be on board until this coming December, because that's when the rule goes into effect. I said, but I will check and see. So I walked into the master stateroom and asked him, and he said, sure, got them on board. And he said, well, could you go and get them? And he said, sure. And he went and got them. And I said, okay, we're going to do some testing. And we called down the other personnel that were on watch, which was Mr. Cousins, Maureen Jones, and Mr. Kagan. And I witnessed a urine test on these three individuals. When we finished the urine test with those, I said, well, how about you? I said, I want to test you too, speaking to the master. And he informed me that he was unable to urinate at the time. And I thought to myself, well, I can't force him to urinate, so I would just have to wait until he's capable.
And did you receive assistance from another crew member in taking of Maureen Jones's sample?
Yes, there was a female third assistant engineer on board, and she was called up from the engine room, and she came into the stateroom, and I informed her what I wanted to do, and Maureen Jones was in agreement with it, and I witnessed them both go into the bathroom, close the door behind them, and come out with a urine sample, which they then gave it over to me, and we sealed it up and put it away.
About what time was this?
Somewhere just shortly before 10 or after 10, I would say.
After the urine samples were taken, what did you do next?
Well, just a little bit after the completion of the urine samples were taken, I went back into the radio room, and the XO was back on the telephone, I believe. Either that or we were waiting for Mr. Lawn to get off the telephone. The corpsman, HS1 Scott Connors, came walking down the passageway. I had no idea that he would arrive that quickly, because I really didn't know he had been dispatched. And after seeing him, I was a bit relieved as far as the completion of the test. And I dragged him away and told him what I wanted. I said that we had an indication of alcohol in this casualty here. I said, I've already drawn urine samples from the three other watch persons. I said, but I only have an indication as of this point that the master might have been drinking. I said, since I've already tested them for urine, I said, I would like for you to go ahead and test him for blood, because he could not give me a urine sample at that time.
He was the first person selected to give a blood sample then?
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. So we went into the master stateroom, And I introduced him to Petty Officer Connors, told him that was that he was a our local hospital corpsman, and he was here to draw blood and take a urine sample. The master acknowledged that, and I said, "And we're going to start with you," talking to the master. And he looked at me and shook his head a little bit. He walked over to his desk, and he picked up a urine bottle, and he walked into the bathroom, and he came out with a sample. He then sat down on the chair, and they prepared to, Petty Officer Connor then took a blood sample from him.
All right, if you just go ahead and describe the events of taking the samples from the other persons.
It was a very slow process to take the blood samples. You have to do a lot of preparation and stuff. You have a lot of signatures, you have a lot of seals, and a lot of administrative type work for each sample that you take. And I believe each sample took approximately 30 to possibly even 40 minutes. The master completed his, and I think Cousins was next. Kagan was after him, and then Maureen Jones. And well, after we took the blood sample from Maureen Jones, Petty Officer Connors was sealing up the box, and he noticed that the urine sample for Maureen Jones had started to leak in the box. So we had to void that sample and take another sample from her, urine sample from her, at which time we called the third engineer back up, and we went through the process again and took another sample from her.
And then who took charge of the samples after that?
Okay, I did the witnessing of the actual transfer from the individual for the urine back over to the box, and then Petty Officer Connors did the sealing and the administrative work of all the samples, both blood and urine. Once they're all complete and perfectly sealed up, I then transferred them completely over to Petty Officer Connors in a garbage bag, and he grabbed his bag, got in a helicopter, and left.
Did you say that when Petty Officer Connors first arrived that he did bring equipment and containers for taking the samples?
No, I did not
okay.
say that.
I meant to ask about that. Did he bring his own
yes.
equipment?
Yes, he did. He came prepared to do blood sampling.
What did he decide to use the ship's tox kits instead?
When he saw the quality of the tox kits on board and realized that that equipment was better than what he had brought. In other words, all the identification labels, instructions, and chain of custody forms and all that stuff was already complete in one package. And it came in a foam box. Each sample kit came in a foam box so that they can be kept in control a lot better than what he had. All he had was a plastic bag with blood sample, test tubes, syringes, and the other stuff.
I'd like to ask a couple questions now on the interviews that you conducted with the helmsman, Robert Kagan, mm-hmm. and with the third mate, Mr. Cousins, and the master. Mm-hmm. With regard to your interview of Mr. Kagan and your statement that I believe is, I think the statements I gave you, or the exhibits were 6K, L, and M, mm-hmm. if you care to refer to them. Is there anything in Mr. Kagan's statement that you now think of that could be added to the statement, or any clarification you'd like to offer in his statement?
Are Mr. Kagan's?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No.
Okay. With regard to Mr. Cousins, you interviewed him when the president was Trooper Fox present at that time?
For whom?
With the third mate, Mr. Cousins.
Yes.
Did he participate and ask any questions?
No, he did not.
He simply listened to what you had to say?
Yes, he did. He felt as though that may be a problem with further litigation if there was some. He wanted to sit in on interviews, and I had absolutely no objection to him doing such, and he did. He did not ask any questions for his own reasons, of which I don't know.
Where did you conduct the interview at?
Soon after arriving on board, I think the master had issued me a stateroom, which is right down the ladder from the wheelhouse.
And did you consult a chart as part of your interview?
Yes, I did, with Mr. Cousins.
Mr. Cousins. And where did that consultation or the chart work occur at, up in the chart house or in that room?
Right. The chart was still up in the wheelhouse, in the chart room, laying on a chart table. And following the interview, I asked Mr. Cousins to come up to the wheelhouse and show me on the chart what he was referring to in the interview.
I'd like to ask the same question regarding your statement. Is there anything now that you can think of that you'd like to add or change in Mr. Cousins' statement?
His statement?
Yes.
My summary?
Yeah, your interview summary.
No, I don't care to change anything because when I wrote this... No, I don't care to change anything because when I wrote this, this was my notes of my summary that I conducted at the time. What I remembered at the time was how I wrote it. I may have left some things out. I may not have.
All right.
But I don't care to change.
Did Mr. Cousins point to a position on the chart where he believed he was supposed to make a course change?
Yes, he did.
Was it a beam above, the ship was then on a course, or had been a course of 180. Was that position a beam of Busby Island light?
Well, I think Busby Island is a mile or two long.
I'm speaking Busby Island light.
Busby Island light?
Mm-hmm.
No, that position was not a beam of Busby Island light.
Was it south of Busby Island light?
Yes, it was.
About how far south was it?
May I step up to the chart?
Yes.
Captain DeLosier is pointing out the location on the map right now. Seated once again. He's answering questions from William Woody from the National Transportation Safety Board.
This is a new copy of NOAA chart 16708.
Uh-huh. Okay,
Mr. Williams.
Mr. DeLosier, if you're going to be working with that chart, maybe we need to put it up so we can see what you're doing.
Sure.
Mr. Colucciello, can you do that, please?
Mark DeLosier is answering questions from William Woody from the National Transportation Safety Board. At issue here is the maneuvers made by Third Mate Greg Cousins, and those maneuvers related to the Busby Island light. Busby Island light was where Cousins.
Mr. Woody, we need to take a 2-minute break for the court reporter.
Okay, we're going to take a break here for a moment. They say about 10 minutes. They need to get some tapes changed and so forth. Mr. Mark DeLosier is the originator of the autopilot theory, by the way, and he is going to be marking stuff on those charts about where the tanker actually was when turns were attempted and so forth.
Which is NOAA chart 16708. And see if you can identify the position that you recollect the third mate showing you as the position for the course change.
Sure.
If you just mark it and label it A, make an X.
Mr. Colucciello, that will be a new exhibit. Is that not true?
Yes.
Mr. DeLosier, when you then interviewed
Mr. Woody, excuse me, let's get this straight first. We'll identify this exhibit for the record.
This will be 12A.
Where's your 12A?
Sorry.
12B then.
This exhibit will be 12 Bravo.
That issue here is where Greg Cousins made his turn relative to the Buzz Beyond the Light.
In the interview with the master, what position did he indicate to you was the position that he told the third mate to change course?
The same position that I just marked on this chart.
How were you able to identify that particular position on the chart?
Well, it's a 38 fathom mark, and that's the position that both third mate Cousins and the master indicated to me on the chart, where they both were in agreement as to where the ship was going to make their turn. After the interview with the third mate, I talked to the master about the subject, at which time he said, yes, this is it, and he went and circled it with a lead pencil.
Did he offer you any rationale as to why the grounding occurred? In the master's interview?
In the master's interview, I asked him what he felt the cause of the casualty was, and he said that you're looking at it, meaning himself, and that he overestimated the navigational abilities of the third mate.
Thank you, Mr. Lozier. That's all the questions I have at this time.
Dr. Burke, do you have questions?
Mr. Delozier, did you at any time search the captain's quarters for alcoholic beverages?
I did a cursory search of his quarters without his consent in the presence of Trooper Fox while I was waiting for the master to come back into his stateroom for the purpose of an interview. At that time, we were both already authorized to be in his stateroom from he invited us in there. Actually, I informed him that I wanted to interview him, and he said, okay, I'll meet you in my stateroom momentarily, at which time we went into his stateroom and we were waiting for him. While I was in his stateroom, I just looked around in both his sleeping quarters and in his office space and looked for any indication of any empty glasses, alcohol or anything of this nature here that was exposed. I did not look in any of his dresser drawers or things of that nature. I found two empty Moosey beer bottles in his garbage can in his sleeping quarters, and I found approximately six bottles of new Moosey beer in his refrigerator, and that's all.
What was your understanding of the regulation concerning the use of alcohol beverages by a marine industry official?
The understanding of the use?
What was your understanding of the regulation concerning the use of alcohol?
Well, we have new regulations that went into effect this past year. And it states in there that following a serious marine accident, that the marine employer will make every effort possible to conduct a blood and alcohol test for people that have been designated to be involved in the casualty. When I boarded the vessel, and since I was directed to conduct an investigation into this casualty, and since the senior member of the marine employer, who was the master, was the person in which I was talking about that may have consumed alcohol, I took it upon myself to initiate testing.
Cation, are you, when you say the new regulation went into effect, are you referring to a particular exhibit, or are you referring to some other documentation about that?
I don't have a list of the exhibits, sir.
Well, let me direct your attention to Exhibit 10A Alpha.
I don't have that before.
Is that the regulation you're referring to?
Dr. Berkey?
Yes.
He doesn't have the exhibits yet.
Okay. You might get 10 beta as well if you have that.
As opposed to 10 beta.
He doesn't, yeah, he's not military.
You're listening to live coverage of the NTSB hearings from the Hotel Captain Cook in Anchorage, Alaska. This is brought to you by KSKA Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN.
Can you hear me?
Do you have those 10
yes,
Alpha?
Yes, I have 10 Alpha and 10 Bravo in front of me.
Okay. Now, which one are you referring to, or are you referring to one of these documents?
I'm referring to 10 Bravo.
10 Bravo. Is the present the regulation that's in place, in vogue right now, actually 10 Alpha, or do you think it is 10 Beta that you're operating under?
I believe I'm operating under both of them at the moment.
May I direct your attention to page 19 of 10 Bravo, please? Yes, page 19.
It's up top.
Now, can you see paragraph 16.205?
Yes.
And if you will go down in that first paragraph A, It says, each employer who employs more than 50 employees required to be tested under this part shall implement the pre-employment testing program required in section 16.210, not later than June 21, '89.
That's correct.
All other employer testing programs required by this shall be implemented not later than December 21, '89.
That's correct.
Okay. And so you were operating under that regulation?
As far as the legal authority of what regulation I was operating under, it was really immaterial to me.
Okay.
I felt the necessity to go ahead and test these individuals because I had the suspicion that one or more of them was under the influence of alcohol.
Would you have tested if you had not smelled alcohol?
I would have attempted to try to test, yes.
Okay, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. LaRouche? And Dr. LaRouche is no longer be with us?
Just for this, he was called
away,
unexpected.
Is this a permanent?
No, it's
not. I would hope that Dr. LaRouche would continue to stay in, if you will please tell him that. Will you identify yourself and tell us if you have any questions?
Yes, my name is Captain Kelly Mitchell. I'm the port captain with the Alaska Marine Highway System, acting as a marine advisor to the state of Alaska on this project. I have a couple of questions, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lozier, how exactly did Mr. Cousins describe that point that you indicated on the chart? Did he give it by verbal description or did he actually point at it?
He took his finger and he pointed right at it.
All right.
And then I asked him again. I said, is this the spot? And he said, yes, it is. I said, how can you identify that? He said, it's a 38-fathom mark right next to a 55-fathom mark.
All right. Thank you. Did you keep the original chart? You indicated that you circled it indicating that 38. Did you keep the original chart with that in pencil as an exhibit?
The master is the one who circled it with the lead pencil. And yes, I kept the original chart up until the time of approximately 2 weeks, which I have since turned it over to the Coast Guard attorney, which it is now in the Coast Guard's possession, yes. And it remains in our possession, I think.
Thank you. When you were doing the interview with the master, was the state trooper, Mr. Fox, with you?
When I did the interview with the master?
Yes.
Yes, he was.
All right, thank you.
Now, during the interview with the master is not when he circled the chart.
All right, thank you.
It was, okay.
Could it possibly be that Captain Hazelwood told you that he told Cousins about the spot when Mr. Cousins got down to the Busby Island to clear the ice on the radar, bring her to the right, and run to the traffic lanes?
Could you run that by me again?
Certainly. Would it be possible that when you interviewed Captain Hazelwood, that he told you that his conversation with Mr. Cousins was that when third mate got down to Busby Island to clear the ice on the radar, you know, when it indicated that it cleared the right ice on the radar, to bring her to the right and rejoin the traffic lanes as his instructions for a course change?
That's not what he told him.
All right.
That's not what he told me.
Could it be that Captain Hazelwood told you that he didn't have any specific instructions to turn at any particular point, but only pointed to the radar and the apex of the ice?
Captain Mitchell?
No.
I think the witness has already said what he was told. Is that not true?
That's absolutely true. He
Thank
told
you.
Me what I just relayed to.
And I think you've already told us that.
Mr. Wood.
All right. The other Thank gentleman. You. I have no further questions.
Mr. Shire?
Thank you,
Captain Deppe? Mr. Delosier, where were you when you got the call to go out to the Valdez?
I was home in bed.
Okay, and how much sleep had you had at that point when you got called?
I had approximately 1 o'clock, 4 hours maybe.
Okay, thanks. That's all the questions I have.
Commander
Walter?
Questions from Exxon Representative Captain William Deppe. Now they're taking questions from Coast Guard Commander Darrell Waldron.
10A, which is the federal regulations operating vessel law intoxicated final rule. 33 CFR part 95 on page, starting on page 7.
Do you have that page?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Sorry, page 8. Were these the regulations that you were using to test by?
Were these the regulations that I was using?
Correct.
Well, these federal registers come in and out of my office almost daily, and I read through them the best that I can, but I don't memorize them, and I don't think there's anyone here that could. It was my understanding that we had new alcohol-related regulations that went into effect, and it was my understanding that as of December of 1988, that they commenced, and that certain portions of those regulations would progressively start to be implemented. And the most severe aspects of these regulations deal, well, not severe, but the starting point was for the large marine employers, being that Exxon is a large marine employer, and that this was a serious marine incident. That is the basis in which I assumed that I had the authority to do what I did.
So you were aware of regulations that had been implemented or were in the process of being implemented that required drug testing in marine casualties, and also was this why you were aware that there was a possibility of test kits being on board or should be on board by December?
That's correct.
One other question. When you were going out to the vessel in the pilot boat, did you have an instance to look at the radar on the pilot boat while you were approaching it?
Yes, I did.
Did you notice any ice in the area?
We had to slow down between Galena Bay and Rocky Point due to ice as we were going out in the pilot boat. The pilot boat was doing a 38 knots as we were going out, and we slowed down considerably so that we could weave around a few ice cubes that were in the water. The indications that I saw on the pilot boat radar indicated that there was approximately 6 targets in that area. We slowed down to a point. The deckhand, which was on the pilot boat, was instructed by the operator of the pilot boat to look out the port window and see if she could observe some of these ice cubes that were in the water. She opened up the window, and as she did so, she got her hair stuck in the fan or in the window or over top of the windshield. And she was stuck there in the fan. And she actually had to cut her hair off of the fan to get out. But anyway, as she got unstuck, I looked out the window and I observed 2 ice cubes in the water, of which approximately 3 to 6 foot in diameter on the surface. And I also observed possibly 1, maybe 2 off of the starboard side of the boat. We slowed down for a period of approximately 2 minutes at the most, and then sped back up and proceeded on out to the Exxon Valdez. As we approached the Exxon Valdez, I looked off into the distance as far as I could see, which approximately was a mile and a half, and I did not observe any ice in the area. As I went up into the wheelhouse and looked out the wheelhouse windows, I could not see any. I went out to the port side bridge wing and looked out there all the way out to the buoy, Bell Buoy, or Bly Reef Buoy 6. I could not see any ice out there. I looked off to the starboard bridge wing, and I could not see any out there. It was dark off of the bow of the ship. I could probably see possibly a mile, and I could not see any out there either.
Did you draw your approximate course coming out to the vessel on the chart there with a pencil, as best you could recollect?
You want it from Port Valdez too?
No, just say from Rocky Point. Would you also label that 38-fathom mark as circles pointed? Circle. It is circled. Okay.
While you're up there, would you put on that exhibit 12B an initial and put your date, the date, today's date, put your initials.
B. Bravo.
Bravo.
Mr. Chairman, would we ensure that that circle that he put on there is labeled as turn point, as pointed out by the master and the third mate?
I think that is in record, Commander.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Lucello?
No questions.
Yeah, I do have just one. I should have asked this earlier of Lieutenant Commander Falkenstein. I'll ask you also, was part of your inspection of the Exxon Valdez related to the worthiness, I won't say seaworthiness of the ship, but some sort of a verification inspection that it wasn't in peril and that the lives of the crew on board was not in danger? And did you coordinate that and discuss that with the master and the chief engineer or whatever?
Yes, absolutely. The purpose for which we were going out there was to assist in any way possible for the purpose of safety of life at sea and property and mitigation of any type of response or pollution.
And then obviously then it was, did you have to actually fill out a form or something certifying that the thing was okay to allow everybody to stay on board, or is it just a
No, it was pretty hard to do at the time. No, there's no such form. We were out there to to utilize our own experience together with the crew's experience, which is of the utmost importance, put all the pieces together the best we can, relay it back to our superiors, and have them make the decisions. Our decision at the time was that she was in a pretty perilous predicament, and there was the possibility of further problems, and that would have been fire, explosion, possibly structural failure, things of this nature here, and we were there to try to mitigate the best we could, whatever we could, for that purpose.
And since the master was smoking on the bridge, and obviously there's not much of a problem with danger of explosive atmosphere or fire, right?
The master is the master of the vessel, and when I arrived and saw him smoking, and after conferring with the executive officer, and in doing our first initial business, which was preliminary assessment and then notification, I did go back up to the wheelhouse, and I did inform the master that it would not be a very prudent thing for him to continue to do due to the fact that there were fumes in the area. He agreed with that, and I didn't see him do it again.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Lozier. You're excused from the stand.
Thank you.
That concludes the witnesses for our second day of hearings. We will recess until tomorrow morning, and let's decide right now, tomorrow morning. My recommendation is that we begin at 8 o'clock, if the parties so agree. Positive, 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 positive. We will reconvene tomorrow morning at 0800. I would like to see the four party coordinators right now. Thank you.
Okay. And the record goes off. That's Lee Dickinson, the chairman of the Board of Inquiry of the National Transportation Safety Board, concluding the second day of testimony in the public hearing regarding the marine accident involving the Exxon Valdez in Valdez, Alaska. We're at the Captain Cook Hotel, and we're coming to you live from the Alaska Public Radio Network and radio station KSKA Anchorage. I'm Steve Heimel. With me is Bruce Melzer. Well, Bruce, kind of a chore to recapitulate today. We've been all over the map. We've been with the Coast Guard, and we've been with the crew, and we've even been with some lady that works for the Department of Transportation to justify their drug testing regulations.
It's been a series of up and downs, but I think right now the most important testimony to recap is Mr. DeLozier, Lieutenant DeLozier's testimony. Some pretty damning evidence that runs in the face of a lot of things that we have heard over the past 2 days, really. Some of the most interesting things he pointed out, that he got on the ship and there was the master of the ship smoking on a vessel which was described to us earlier this morning as being so filled with fumes that the chief mate was thinking about grabbing an air pack or some type of gas mask. A vessel that was so full of fumes that the chief mate said that there was no way he could determine if there was alcohol on the breath of the captain. DeLozier also said that he was able to smell alcohol on the breath of the captain from 4 feet away. And so it certainly casts some doubt on previous testimony we've heard where crew members, people who were on the bridge, said they didn't smell anything.
And it was testimony which certainly brought things to a climax today for the people who stuck with it all day long. I think they finally got some excitement as the day wore on. Mark DeLozier was, along with Dan Lawn of the Department of Environmental Conservation, among the first people to climb aboard the Exxon Valdez. And both of them were there for a considerable length of time after that. There was a lot of discussion about the late alcohol testing for the captain and other personnel. He explained that. That's the first time we've really heard this explanation of it, why it took 10 to 11 hours after the accident before there was any testing for alcohol use. He said it was just a matter of the chain of custody and having the proper equipment and having the proper personnel. They finally did find a corpsman who was on the staff of the Coast Guard who got out there, and they also found the equipment on board. Required by new regulations to draw blood from the captain. Earlier in the day, we heard something about the significance of that 0.6 reading on the captain's blood alcohol. We had a toxicologist who testified that if you take it all the way back from that 11-hour lag and just say, well, how long, you know, the process of the body dissipating the alcohol, how drunk was he at the time? The answer was pretty smashed, about 2.2, which is drunk in anybody's book.
Now, that was based, the toxicologist's assumption was based on the fact, or based on an assumption that Hazelwood had not had anything to drink after he left Valdez. One thing that we did hear, which may account for some of the fact that people smelled alcohol on Hazelwood's breath, Mark DeLozier from the Coast Guard said that he found two bottles of Moosey low alcohol beer in the captain's garbage can. He said that he did a quick unauthorized search of the captain's quarters, unauthorized in the sense that the captain didn't know he was doing the search, although DeLozier was invited into the captain's quarters. So they did find some, at least a low alcohol beverage on board at the time. There was also testimony submitted into the record by the National Transportation Safety Board that the captain was seen drinking a clear liquid with other members of his crew down at a bar before getting onto the Exxon Valdez.
And indeed, crew personnel, at least one of whom will be testifying later in these hearings, were said to be with the captain at that time. So we may hear more about what the captain was doing for lunch and when he picked up the pizza and all that sort of thing is now emerging out onto the record. Perhaps most germane to the point of this entire inquiry was the discussion from Mr. DeLozier about what the captain and the third mate told him about the position of the vessel at the time that the turn was attempted or turn was made, depending on who you're talking to. Basically, it really looks like they were kind of right in harm's way when they tried to make the turn.
And if I'm correct, DeLozier's theory is in part that the autopilot was in fact on and that while they were trying to make a turn, they were in fact unable to make the turn because the autopilot was operating. Is that correct, Steve?
That was the DeLozier theory, and as far as I know, he hasn't really pulled back from that, although but there have been some media accounts.